Southern Fried True Crime covers cases that are not suitable for young listeners, and there may also be some explicit language used. Listener discretion is advised. We live in a time when racial epithets and homophobic slurs are not tolerated in society. It's not that those words aren't still weaponized. They are, especially by bigots hiding behind keyboards, but also by strangers on the street. Those words are easy to fling rather than fight with intelligence and reason. But there are other words that don't get the same attention. I think it's because white people largely don't believe we have room to complain about it. The term hillbilly has been railed against and also embraced in different generations. It's complicated and depends on where you live and your age. The word redneck has also been embraced, often ironically and with humor, but sometimes proudly by people who do use racist slurs themselves, perpetuating the stereotype. The etymology of cracker is interesting too, and honky, though you rarely hear that one anymore. Both terms are considered anti-white, but not necessarily slurs. But what about white trash? It's actually not a word that people of color would typically use. It's one that white people inflict on each other. Calling someone white trash means you are above them, socially and economically. And calling someone white trash isn't new. It holds the same negative connotation that welfare queen does for the black community. It assumes that a group of people choose to be poor. It implies laziness, promiscuity, and most importantly, poor breeding. Whether we admit it or not, we do have a caste system in this country, holding people of all colors down. Welcome to episode 87, The Murder of Tina Andrews, White Trash Justice. Before I start today's episode, I want to thank author Trent Brown. Without him, this episode would not be possible. Tina Andrews' case is really obscure, and as you will learn, many documents were lost, hidden, or destroyed, and one trial transcript was never even created. It's not the kind of case you can Google and quickly find out the story. In fact, if you Google it, you will only find articles about Mr. Brown's book, Murder in Macomb, the Tina Andrews case. Mr. Brown is a native of Macomb, Mississippi, and was in a unique position to access available documents, as well as personally interview people connected with this 50-year-old case who were still alive at the time of his research. His insight into Macomb, both in the time of Tina's murder and modern day, are invaluable to understanding what happened to her and how the system failed her. 12-year-old Tina Andrews was murdered in the dog days of August, 1969, just 4 days after the Manson murders. Considering the events of the year, Tina's murder did dominate local newspapers more than you might think. 1969 was not just the end of the decade, but the end of an era. Protests against the Vietnam War were at their peak, when some 250,000 people marched in Washington, D.C. in October, then 500,000 in a second march that November in response to Nixon's plea to the silent majority for support. Shortly after, he signed the draft lottery bill in December to determine the order of call to military service for mandatory conscription young men were required to sign up for at age 18. The United States put the first man on the moon with the Apollo 11 mission, as an estimated 600 million people watched worldwide on television. It's the year Sesame Street premiered on PBS, and the Beatles gave their final live performance that January and released their last album, Abbey Road, that September. The Woodstock Festival in July would come to symbolize the peaceful Flower Child movement. While the Altamont Free Concert in December signified a violent end to the 60s free love hippie culture. But not much of these national events affected day-to-day life in Macomb, Mississippi, which was still reeling from the violence of the civil rights movement. As Mr. Brown wrote, it was one of the most notoriously violent centers of resistance. While much of the world focused on the war in Vietnam, a violent social war for civil rights was being waged in the United States. Pike County, where the town of Macomb is located, and surrounding areas were Klan territory. Freedom riders, voter registration drives, and other demonstrations wrought violence from the KKK in Macomb for years. With over a dozen bombings, Macomb became known as the bomb capital of the world in 1964, the year the Civil Rights Act was signed into law. But by 1969, white business owners and other white influential citizens were tired of this reputation. Aside from the lasting trauma of violence, the bad publicity was affecting new business and growth in the area. Despite its national reputation, Macomb was a small town with a population of around 12,000 people, a number that hasn't changed much in recent years. In 1969, the town was still deeply segregated, maintained by law and by custom, as Mr. Brown points out. There were 8,000 white citizens and 4,000 black. The Macomb elite might have wanted to end the violent reputation of the city, but they weren't really interested in actually integrating their town. Black residents lived mostly in South Macomb. And as with any small town, then and now, segregation was not solely based on skin color. Poor white people, like Tina and her family, lived in the marginalized areas of downtown or East Macomb, while the upper class tended to live uptown or in the nicer suburbs. I'm going to pause now for a short commercial break. Tina Marie Andrews was born on March 23, 1957, to a couple named Fred and Doris Andrews, who lived on Oak Street in Macomb. She was the youngest of eight children. She had three brothers and four sisters. Tina was close to her older sisters, Donna and Winifred. Both were sort of mother figures to Tina, as their own mother would have had a lot on her hands. The kids came in quick succession, with Tina being less than 2 years younger than Donna. Tina attended Otkin Elementary School and was about to start the fifth grade when she was murdered. She was tall for her age, with dark hair, and was already well-developed. Despite the one photograph you can find of Tina, the one used at trial, she appeared older in person to some people. To others, her mannerisms showed her true age, and her school picture shows the little girl she really still was. The modest brick home she lived in was a block or so from Delaware Avenue, a mile from downtown Macomb. It sits across from an auto zone today, clearly a busy street. Tina, like many kids her age at that time, walked around town more freely than we would allow children today. This is well before the age of stranger danger, and all kinds of kids typically walk to school. But especially in Tina's neighborhood, that was so close to drive-ins, movie theaters, soda shops, and other hangouts for teenagers. This wasn't the suburbs, this was downtown, and Tina and her peers took advantage of the proximity and freedom. And as I've told you, Tina was not from a well-to-do family. She was not a good student, and not what the Macomb elite would think of as a proper young lady. Even within her family, her father Fred was the black sheep, and was often shunned. Naturally, this extended to his wife and children. Fred Andrews was an unlucky man, to put it nicely. His business ventures didn't go well, and one relative characterized him as poor, pitiful Fred, always having to be bailed out by another family member. Some of Fred's siblings forbade their children to associate with him or his family, though he had one brother he could always turn to. The house on Oak Street had already been damaged by fire from a pan of grease in the kitchen the year before. There never seemed to be enough money. Tina wore mostly hand-me-downs, though the night she disappeared, she wore a new blouse her sister had bought her. On August 13th, after dinner, Tina and her sister Donna were supposed to be doing the dishes. Tina said she had to go to the bathroom. After a while, when she didn't come back, Doris went and checked, and Tina had slipped out of the house. Donna had generously shared her birthday money and bought Tina a pink and white blouse from Gibson's, a discount shop off the highway. It was low cut in the front and back, showing a little bit of skin, but not exactly too revealing. Tina chose her new blouse to wear that evening. She also wore a pair of green shorts that a cousin had left at their home. Her older sister, Winifred, was sure of this later when it was time to identify Tina's remains because she recognized where she had sewn a new button on the well-worn shorts herself. Tina wore a padded 32B size bra, a hand-me-down from Winifred, held together with a safety pin. After Tina slipped out that night, her family never saw her again. But they were not alarmed right away. Tina was independent, and they figured she would show up eventually. Tina had other brothers and sisters living at home who often behaved the same way. They went to school when they felt like it. And as author Trent Brown points out, there was no law against this. Mississippi had repealed compulsory attendance laws in the 1950s to help stop the integration of black and white children. In the Jim Crow era, this wasn't unusual. And a family of the Andrews' social standing would not have been able to afford private school. They would have worked a lot of menial jobs. The press would say she was often unsupervised. But again, for that time period, a 12-year-old on her own wasn't that unusual. And Tina had grown up watching her older siblings skip school and take off for a night on the town whenever they wanted. As she grew older, Tina was no different. Her parents did question her comings and goings to the point where she would often just slip out rather than ask. It's easier to ask for forgiveness than permission. And in a home with so many economic challenges and mouths to feed, Tina slipped through the cracks. Her parents did not report her missing to the authorities. Though her parents would never speak publicly, her sisters did, and they said her family didn't trust the police. They thought they could find Tina themselves. While they didn't jump into action that night, they did look for her over the next several days. Again, this was 1969, not the era of satanic panic or stranger danger. Kids hitchhiked, and no one thought anything of it. And as for her family searching for her, rather than calling the police, there could be any number of reasons. Distrust of the police, sure. While they were not black and in constant fear of law enforcement, they were of the lowest social white class. As poor white trash as many considered the Andrews to be, they would be more likely to get in trouble with the law than to seek out help. Maybe her family was afraid Tina would be sent away as a delinquent. So for 10 days, Tina was missing. And even after her body was discovered on August 23rd, her identity was not announced to the press until September 19th, though authorities had commented they believed it was a missing Macomb girl. There happened to be four missing young women at the time, though we don't know if Tina's name was in this group. It seems as though Tina's family didn't call in until the reports of a body being found in a local oil field appeared in the paper. Workers from the Sun Oil Company had found the body while out checking equipment after smelling a foul odor. Tina's body was discovered in an oil field way down Delaware Avenue and just past the new highway. 10 days in the hot August Mississippi sun will do a lot of damage to a corpse. To get to the oil field, you had to turn down Schmidt Road, a twisting off-road that turned into a smaller dirt road that led to the oil field. The place was not actually as hidden as it sounds, and it was known to be a popular lover's lane, and also a place where people dumped trash and furniture they didn't want. One of the perplexing things in Tina's murder is this spot. If you were taking someone out there to kill them, your chances of being discovered were pretty high. A lot of kids and young adults would come there to go parking, or just drink beer, smoke cigarettes, and hang out. Tina was found under an overturned couch. The couch held in the heat and humidity and sped up decomposition even more. Tina's body was skeletal when it was found. Initially, only the remaining hair left on her head identified her as white, and estimates put her age around 18 to 20 years old, probably because she was 5'7" tall. She was found only in the green shorts she was last seen in, and they were on backwards. Her bra, underwear, and blouse were found nearby. This obviously would look like a sex crime, but in 1969, They did not have the technology to test for DNA on her clothing, and her body was in such a state of decomposition that it probably would not have yielded that kind of evidence either. Authorities quickly saw the bullet hole in the base of her skull, and a .38 caliber bullet was found in her right nasal cavity. Her jaw was broken. It looked like someone had punched her hard before she was shot to death. Originally, authorities believed the body had lain there for 3 to 6 weeks. And while DNA testing wasn't available yet, the study of insect growth was a more accurate resource for determining time of death. When they announced the identity of the body found, it matched the evidence the pathologist found with insect growth. A week to 2 weeks at most was the estimate, and Tina had been missing for 10 days. But local authorities went a step further and shipped her remains and other evidence to the FBI crime lab. The lab confirmed the age of the body from other evidence, including examination of her teeth. So where did Tina go when she slipped out that night? Who was she with? Even for an independent child like Tina, it's not that hard to find out who their friends are, who they hang out with, and where they might have gone. But police remained stymied, with no suspects or even leads for months. And as I just said, it's not that difficult to look into someone's life. But the investigation seemed more focused on looking into unsavory characters in the area, rather than following Tina's actual movements that night. Tina's body was finally returned to her family, and she was laid to rest in Hollywood Cemetery on October 3rd, less than a mile from her home. But it wasn't until February of 1971 that District Attorney Joe Piggott got a break in the case. Of course, Tina wasn't alone that night. She was with a friend. A friend who could recall every detail of that horrifying night because she kept having nightmares about it. After Tina's body was found, her friend went to her own mother, who told her to stay out of it. But she remained very troubled and needed someone to talk to. And that someone placed a call to the DA and broke the case wide open. I'm going to pause now for a word from one of our sponsors. Warby Parker is a new affordable concept in eyewear. Glasses start at $95, including prescription lenses. And Warby Parker is committed to providing exceptional vision care online and in stores. They also offer eye exams along with eyeglasses, contact lenses, and sunglasses. I have a small head, but I also wear progressive lenses. So finding a frame that fits my face without making me look like a bug is hard. I took the Warby Parker quiz, and within minutes, I had many different styles and colors to choose from. I chose 5 different styles, and every single one of them fit my face right. And I loved the styles and vibrant colors. The Warby Parker aesthetic is vintage inspired with a contemporary twist, which is not just my own personal style, but tends to complement faces of all shapes and sizes. And every pair is custom fit with anti-reflective polycarbonate prescription lenses. Even better, for every pair of glasses sold, Warby Parker donates a pair of glasses to someone in need. 1 billion people globally lack access to glasses. I love to support companies who care about the less fortunate in our world. Try Warby Parker's free home try-on program. Order 5 pairs of glasses to try at home for free for 5 days. There's no obligation to buy. Go to warbyparker.com/southernfried. Warby Parker ships the glasses to you for free and includes a prepaid return shipping label. You've got nothing to lose. Try 5 pairs of glasses at home for free at warbyparker.com/southernfried. Billie Jo Lambert was a 13-year-old friend of Tina Andrews and had been with her on the last night of her life. She lived in East Macomb, considered the working-class district, and across town from Tina. Later at trial, her character would be just as maligned as Tina's, poor white trash. She was also one of 8 children. Her parents were Pat and George Ann Lambert, but her father had died in July before Tina's murder in August. The marital status of Billie Jo's parents is somewhat unclear, but her mother held down 3 jobs and her father was living in Louisiana at the time of his death. I think it's fair to assume that they were separated and had been for some time, especially since later, in court testimony, Billie Jo couldn't remember exactly when her father had died. On the night of August 13th, 1969, Tina and Billy Joe had met up at a place called the Tiger's Den. It was up Delaware Street on the corner of Main and Railroad Boulevard, an easy walk from Tina's house. And it was a hangout for teenagers, not a bar. They did not serve alcohol. The kids listened to records, danced, drank soda, and just hung out. At the Tiger's Den, Tina ran into another girl she knew. Tina felt like this girl had been paying too much attention to a boy she liked and considered her boyfriend. You can remember teen romances at this age. They are unrealistic, confusing, and often without mutual attraction. We don't really know. We don't even know who the boy was. But Billy Joe said that Tina told this other girl to back off. It looked like it was becoming heated, and Billy Joe, unlike some teens who might egg on a silly fight, diffused the situation. She knew it wouldn't be tolerated in a place like the Tiger's Den. The small club for teens had been organized by the town's junior auxiliary, a ladies' social club, and membership was strictly for teens aged 12 to 19. It was named the Tiger's Den after the mascot for the McCombs Public School sports teams. After Billy Joe had averted the simmering fight, she got Tina to go outside with her. They walked down Railroad Boulevard to the corner of Railroad and Canal Street and sat down on the curb to talk. According to Billy Joe, a third girl was with them. She said this girl was already with Tina when she got to the Tiger's Den that night, but she didn't know her or even remember her name. As they sat there chatting, a car pulled up with two white men in the front seat. One of the guys asked if the girls needed a ride home. Billy Joe said the driver looked familiar to her, and Tina seemed to know the other guy in the passenger seat. They said, sure, why not, and the three girls got in the back seat. It was a four-door car. Billy Joe was sure because the men didn't have to move their seats or get out to let the girls in. I'll point out again that in 1969, lots of kids accepted rides, and these girls seemed to vaguely know the men. And at their ages, 13 and under, they were probably a bit flattered too, without sensing danger. The man driving took a left on Delaware, the main drag, going west. Billy Joe lived in East Macomb, but she knew they were still close to Tina's house, so she didn't think much of it. After about a mile, the third girl asked the men to let her out. They stopped at the next corner and dropped off this girl and then kept driving. They were about two blocks from Tina's house when she said they could let her out there. But they didn't stop. They said they needed to go for gas. There were several filling stations on Delaware Avenue, but still they didn't stop. One of them told the girls they weren't going home just yet. This is when Billy Joe and Tina got scared. They insisted that they didn't mind walking the rest of the way home, but the men said no, they were going parking. In 1969, that meant they were going to a lover's lane to make out. Apologies if I am over-explaining, but I want to make sure younger listeners or foreign listeners get the connotation. And that is that these two grown men saw two girls, aged 12 and 13, and seemed to consider them appropriate sexual partners. Billy Joe said the men seemed tickled or smug and told the girls that afterwards they could tell anyone all about it if they wanted to. They continued down Delaware Avenue, crossing over the new highway, Interstate 55. They were now out of downtown. There were no streetlights, no stores, and it wasn't a residential area. Frightened, the girls made a plan in the back seat. As soon as the car stopped, they would jump out and run. But they also calmly asked the men again to just drop them off where they were and they would walk back. But the man kept driving and soon turned down Schmidt Lane, the dark, twisting lane that led to the dirt road that would take them to the oil field. They drove through woods and pastures until they reached the deserted spot. The moment the car stopped, Billy Joe opened her passenger side door and jumped out. She had a clear shot to the road. However, Tina didn't. Her door was blocked by something. Billy Joe later never said exactly what. When Tina jumped out, she had to go around the front of the car. And by the time she did, Billy Joe saw that the driver had jumped out of the car and grabbed Tina's arm. She heard Tina call the man a son of a bitch and told him to let her go. Billie Joe heard the man say no one called him that and got away with it. She was still running, but looked back when she heard this and saw the man hit Tina in the face. Now completely terrified, Billie Joe ran as fast as she could, all the way home back to East Macomb. She lived on Cherry Street, over 3 miles from the dark oil field, and she had been barefoot. She said she didn't stop at any homes or businesses along the way. She just ran home. Her family was still up watching television and were mad that Billie Joe had stayed out too late again. Like Tina, she often roamed the streets of Macomb at night. She said no one wanted to hear any excuses, especially her mother, so she said nothing and went to bed. Her feet were swollen and bruised. She had been crying, but she just wanted to go to bed. Billie Joe never saw Tina again. For the next week, she was anxious and upset and didn't know what to do. School wasn't back in yet, so not seeing Tina wasn't that unusual at first, and no one in Tina's family ever asked her if she had seen Tina lately, so she tried to brush it off. She hoped her friend was okay. But she was also scared that those men would come looking for her, because now she remembered how she knew the driver. He was a Macomb policeman. Even when it became clear that Tina was missing, Billie Joe remained frozen. When the unidentified body was found, Billie Joe did tell her mother. But her mother, like Tina's family, had no love for the police. While they did not experience the police brutality that Black Macomb citizens did, they were still considered low class, and they didn't feel protected by the police. Billie Joe's mother told her to keep her mouth shut, that she could get in deep trouble over this. Accusing a police officer would definitely make Billie Joe a target, and probably her whole family too. So she still said nothing. She lived with the nightmares and was probably experiencing PTSD. Meanwhile, the Macomb Police Department was still investigating Tina's murder. At the scene when Tina's body was found, the Mississippi State Police, an FBI agent, and the district attorney were on the scene. While Tina's remains were sent to the FBI for further analysis, local Macomb police had retained the official investigation. But they got nowhere. A reward for $2,000 had been raised, and no one came forward. District Attorney Joe Pigott suspected that the crime wasn't premeditated. While it certainly looked like a sex crime, maybe it had not started out that way. Maybe Tina had gone willingly, and then something went wrong. Shooting someone in a well-trafficked lover's lane was foolish, and they didn't do much to hide the body. They just dumped a couch over it, probably rushing to leave the scene. In February of 1971, a year and a half later, the DA Joe Pigott got a call. It was a young woman who said she knew someone who had been at the oil field with Tina that night. Pigott questioned her, and she gave details that only a witness would have known. The woman on the phone was actually a teenage friend of Billie Joe Lambert's. She came in alone the first time in early February and made a statement. And then she convinced Billie Joe to go back with her and talk to the DA. Naturally, he at first wondered why they came straight to him instead of the police. After listening to Billie Joe's story, it was clear. Billie Joe had been scared, and even her mother told her not to say anything. But she had confided in her friend, who talked her into coming in. Billie Joe Lambert accused two Macomb police officers of picking up her and Tina that night, and she identified one, Richard McIntosh, as the man she saw hit Tina in the face. She said that Tina had told her she knew the other guy was a cop. Billie Joe didn't recognize him at the time, but a year and a half had passed, and now she had seen him in uniform around town and knew his name to be Ted Fleming. In March of 1971, Pigott took Billie Joe before a grand jury and got two indictments against McIntosh and Fleming. After the officers were indicted, the chief of police commented publicly that his department had been working with county officers for about 2 months. Why now? Why was the county now involved? They had not been before. And the two officers had already taken voluntary leave before the indictments were announced. Joe Pigott never said specifically but it's highly unlikely that he warned the chief that the two officers were about to be indicted. He was already worried how much the original investigation would have been tainted by two officers being involved. There was no evidence that the men were related in any way to the investigation, but later, in two different trials, Piggott and his predecessor felt that the department was, quote, not overly forthcoming, though neither of them ever alleged a cover-up. But it is interesting that 2 months before Piggott got the tip from Billy Joe's friend, Macomb police had brought in county investigators to assist, and both men went on voluntary leave before anyone supposedly knew about the indictments. And who were these two policemen? At the time of his indictment, Ted Fleming was 37 years old. He had joined the Macomb Police Department in 1965 as a desk sergeant, but resigned for a while to work at Sears. He rejoined the force in 1966 and worked as a patrolman, the type of police officer people would see around town. He had trained at the Mississippi Law Enforcement Training Academy, and he did work with small investigations. While he had been called a veteran on the force, his job mainly consisted of traffic incidents and arresting shoplifters. And he would have only been on the job less than 3 years when Tina Andrews was murdered. Richard McIntosh was 25 years old and a 1965 graduate of Macomb High School, where he had been a star athlete. He briefly attended Southwest Mississippi Junior College, but did not graduate. And he was a member of the Mississippi National Guard. This ensured he did not serve in Vietnam, but it would still be a point for his good character later at trial. At the time of his indictment, he had only been a police officer with Macomb for 1 year, having joined the force in March of 1970. That would be 7 months after Tina's murder. And this would be a big problem for Billy Joe in his coming trials. But he may have worked as an auxiliary officer, helping only with directing traffic. Those men wore the same police uniform, and the average citizen would not know the difference. However, there was no proof of his employment. The Macomb City clerk said that they did not keep records on this kind of temporary employee, and McIntosh denied ever working as one. Regardless of these inconsistencies, the DA moved forward with the case. He felt that Billy Joe's testimony was compelling, even though he knew this was going to be an uphill battle. Both men hired great defense attorneys, particularly Richard McIntosh. B.D. Statham was on the County Board of Supervisors for over 25 years. He was a former FBI agent, a Navy veteran, and was considered one of the best attorneys in the state. Ted Fleming hired an attorney from a neighboring county who had tried many cases in Magnolia, where the Pike County Courthouse was located. The first thing Fleming's attorney did was file a motion for severance so that Fleming would be tried separately from McIntosh. This is not unusual. It's a common strategy, and probably even more important in this case. While Billie Jo Lambert said that she recognized Ted Fleming, she did not see him assault Tina. She saw Richard McIntosh do that. The original trial date for McIntosh was set for April 5, 1971. But with a flurry of pre-trial motions, his lawyers managed to delay the start. And on April 9th, the March term for the Pike County Circuit Court came to a close. That meant both trials would be carried over until the next term started in October. I'm going to pause now for a final word from our sponsors. Online retailers know the frustration of getting orders out quickly and at the best price, especially smaller businesses. It's confusing to pick a carrier who has the best rates. How can you track your orders? That's why you need ShipStation. It's the fastest, easiest, and most affordable way to manage and ship your orders. In just a few clicks, you'll manage your orders, print labels, and get your product out the door fast, making your customers happy. ShipStation makes it so easy. No matter where you're selling, Amazon, Etsy, or from your own website, website like I do, ShipStation brings all of your orders into one simple interface. You can manage your shipments from any device, even your cell phone. ShipStation works with all major carriers, including USPS, FedEx, UPS, and even Amazon Fulfillment, so you can easily compare and choose the best shipping solution for you and your customer. ShipStation also offers big discounts on shipping costs usually not available to small companies. You can access the same postage discounts that are usually reserved for Fortune 500 companies. No wonder ShipStation is the number one choice for online retailers. You'll ship more in less time at the best rates available. And act now. Southern Fried True Crime listeners can try ShipStation for free for 60 days when you use offer code SOUTHERNFRIED. There's absolutely no risk. You can start your free trial without even entering your credit card info. Just visit ShipStation.com, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage, and type in Southern Fried. That's ShipStation.com, then enter code Southern Fried. ShipStation.com. Make ship happen. Sometimes you just need someone to talk to, not a family member or a friend, but someone objective. And finding a therapist in your area is not easy. Finding one quickly is even harder. BetterHelp Online Counseling is there for you. BetterHelp has over 3,000 licensed therapists in all 50 states treating depression, stress, anxiety, trauma, grief, and other issues that so many of us suffer from. From your phone, laptop, or tablet, you can connect with a professional counselor via text, chat, phone, or video, and start communicating with your counselor in under 24 hours. If you're not happy with your counselor, you can request a new one at any time with no additional charges. And everything you share is confidential, and there is even financial aid for those who qualify. Best of all, it's truly an affordable option. Southern Fried True Crime listeners get 10% off your first month with the discount code Southern. Why not get started today? Go to betterhelp.com/southern. Simply fill out a questionnaire to help them assess your needs and get matched with a counselor you'll love. That's betterhelp.com/southern. Over the summer, as DA Joe Piggott prepared for trial, a popular police captain named John Sharpling suddenly passed away at the early age of 40. The tall and bulky captain was a former beloved football player and was well known to everyone in the county. His nickname was Big John, and he cut an imposing figure in law enforcement. And unlike most policemen, he had a degree from Mississippi Junior College. He was well respected and was one of the chief investigators in Tina's case. Trent Brown wrote that to this day, local people wonder if the outcome of the trials would have been different if Sharpling had lived. It was rumored that Big John had worked hard on Tina's case and had found out who all was involved and what exactly happened to Tina in that oil field. Now Piggott had lost his testimony for trial, and when another officer asked his wife for his notes on the case, she said she didn't have them. If his notes were in the original police files, they were not entered in as evidence, and as author Trent Brown was to discover, they were not public record. On October 13, 1971, the cases against McIntosh and Fleming were finally ready to be scheduled. Both men had remained free on bond, though they were still suspended from the police department. In one of his final pretrial motions, McIntosh's attorney subpoenaed the Macomb School Superintendent, requesting all school records for Tina Andrews and Billy Joe Lambert. The judge ruled in his favor. But why would the girls' school records be relevant? In later years, it was one of the DA's biggest regrets that he didn't fight harder to keep those records out of evidence. They were used at trial purely to smear the character of both young girls. The jury chosen for McIntosh's trial had 8 white people, only one of those a woman, and 4 black men. Years later, one of these black jurors told author Trent Brown that the white juror spoke to them like they were dumb and tried to bully them into their votes. He said one of the white jurors proclaimed from the very start that he could not vote to convict, no matter what the evidence showed. This was not a great start for what was already going to be a difficult case. It was fully circumstantial and relied on the eyewitness testimony of a teenage girl, now 2 years after the murder. In the prosecutor's opening statement, he promised to prove conclusively that the remains were those of Tina Andrews, something the defense intended to dispute. However, he could not then or ever provide eyewitness testimony that Richard McIntosh had murdered Tina. Defense attorney B.D. Statham came out swinging. He immediately called the state's main witness, Billy Jo Lambert, a teenager, a young lady of ill repute, revealing that the now 15-year-old girl had just had a baby out of wedlock. He went on to say that the victim, Tina Andrews, was also a young lady of ill repute, one who was, quote, allowed to go places and do things that were unusual for a girl her age. The words were inflammatory, but had the exact effect he wanted. He had basically just called a 12-year-old murder victim a whore. The phrase lady of ill repute is antique now as a descriptor, but the connotation in 1971 would definitely be sexual. It was basically a polite way of calling a woman a prostitute. Statham would go back and forth in his portrayal of Tina Andrews. She was either from a white trash family who didn't supervise her, maintaining that she was a child, or he would swing to the young lady of ill repute angle, subtly aging Tina into a woman who had many sexual relationships. He ended his opening statement by saying that whatever Richard McIntosh had done on that particular evening, Tina and Billy Joe were likely involved in things no respectable girl should have been. It was victim blaming at its finest, and it was very effective. The state opened their case with expert witnesses to prove the remains found at the oil field were indeed Tina Marie Andrews. They had an expert witness from the National Institute of Dental Research in Bethesda, Maryland, on the stand to show the similar characteristics of the teeth found on the body to those in a photograph of Tina Andrews. A local dentist had already early in the investigation found that Tina had several rotten teeth and desperately needed dental work. From his estimation, she had never been to a dentist. This is not at all unusual for a poor family in that era. The expert witness, Marie Nyland, had taken a school photograph of Tina smiling and blown it up to show a particular tooth that had calcified and turned dark, and compared it to the photographs of teeth found on the body in the oil field. Without dental records, this was the next best way to prove a match. She explained the process of discovering exact measurements in both pictures and was a very credible and detailed witness. Nyland had been with the Institute for 20 years, and yet in his cross-examination, Statham kept referring to her as young lady. But Nyland held her own against him, and the judge often agreed with her and overruled Statham. But his treatment of this witness, a grown woman and a scientist with decades of experience, was a harbinger of what was to come. Winifred Andrews Mullen was called to the stand to help prove the identification of her sister. She had been in a unique position to help because she was the one who had repaired the shorts Tina had been wearing that night. But rather than attack her memory of Tina's clothing, Statham started peppering her with questions about Tina's school attendance and grades. Winifred had not lived at home with Tina at the time of her death and didn't know of her school records. She answered that truthfully. She lived in Louisiana then and at the time of the trial, which was no secret. Statham then asked her why her family had not reported Tina missing. Again, she didn't live there at the time, but she insisted, quote, I've lived there before and I wouldn't have called the police either. Her answer showed the mistrust Tina's family had for the police. But she was also able to point out that her family did attempt to locate Tina in other ways, perhaps more effective than going to the police. They had placed an ad with a request for information on a Baton Rouge television station, an ABC affiliate that was watched by many Macomb residents. Like the female expert witness, Winifred held her own on the stand. But that doesn't mean that Statham didn't score points. He was attacking Tina's character through her family, their seeming lack of supervision, their failure to contact the police, and their mistrust of the police, all subtly spoke to the Andrews family social standing. Her sister Donna, less than 2 years older than Tina, fared much the same on the stand. She was also called to help prove the identification of her sister, not just by the clothing, but she confirmed the dental issues Tina had. But again, Statham brought up Tina's school records and then attacked Tina's character with questions about her social habits, her reputation, and of course, he again characterized Tina's parents as neglectful. Throughout this trial, the defense was able to paint a picture of a family of low respectability. Though the word social standing were not specifically used, everything brought up spoke to the Andrews' place in the community and the way they parented their children. Fred and Doris Andrews were not subpoenaed for this trial and did not testify. Piggott would later say he did not wish to put them through the ordeal, but it's more likely he knew they would be annihilated on the stand. Another problem early in the trial, Macomb policemen were literally standing in the courtroom near the jury box. It looked like intimidation, though they would later insist it was a show of solidarity with Richard McIntosh. Black jurors would later confirm that it was indeed intimidating to have the officer standing so close. The police presence, in contrast with how the Andrews family was portrayed, was stark. And finally, during one recess, the judge instructed the courtroom that, quote, "There are plenty of seats out there, so sit down, all of you. That includes you, policemen." The state's star witness was, of course, Billie Jo Lambert. She spent hours on the witness stand, mostly defending her own reputation. By the time of trial, she was 15 years old and had a six-week-old baby. She no longer looked like the preteen girl she was at the time of Tina's murder. Simply put, the jury now saw an unwed mother from the wrong side of the tracks. But she never wavered in her identification of Richard McIntosh or of Ted Fleming. And she also testified that Richard McIntosh had contact with her after Tina's murder. Once, he came to her house and tried to get her to get in his car, offering her a beer. She refused and went back inside the house. Her family did call the police to report his unwelcome presence at their house. A patrol car came out and he left. But there was no evidence that the department followed up on the complaint, though it would have been one of their officers harassing an underage girl. And unfortunately, some details had become cloudy in the 2 years that had passed. Dates in particular. As I told you before, McIntosh wasn't actually a police officer at the time of Tina's murder. But it is possible he worked as an auxiliary officer, though there are no official records to prove it one way or another. But Billie Jo couldn't remember time or dates that she saw him after Tina's murder. All she knew was that it was after August of 1969. She was clear about the details of the night, but about her family, her father's death, and other personal matters, she was fuzzy. Statham seized on this, thundering that with the exception of identifying his client, she couldn't just always answer, "I don't know," or "I don't remember." Statham then moved on to asking Billie Jo who the father of her baby was and if she had been pregnant at the grand jury proceedings, a completely irrelevant question that Piggott objected to and the judge sustained. As for Billie Jo's testimony about the night of Tina's murder, her story did not change, but it was confusing. She explained that Tina knew one of the men, Ted Fleming, to be a policeman. She was not asked how she recognized McIntosh on direct examination, but she was asked to point him out in court. When she did, witnesses said he turned a beet red. Piggott did ask when she saw him next, and she said, quote, "Directing traffic. He was police." We have to remember that 2 years passed. It was only 7 months after Tina's death that McIntosh became a police officer. Whether she recognized him as an auxiliary officer or just later realized he was a police officer, it doesn't change her identification of him as the man in the car that night, the man she saw hit Tina, the man who later came to her house. Statham also grilled her on the identity of the third girl that night, the one the men had let out of the car. She insisted she didn't know her or her name. He even brought up a name and accused Billie Jo of asking this girl to support her story. Billie Jo strongly denied it, and the teenager, named Beverly, was never called to give testimony. It did look strange that Billie Jo didn't figure out who the third girl was later, so she was probably protecting her. As you may have guessed now, the defense had a strong case. Statham put his own expert witness on, who disagreed with the state's witnesses. The decomposition of the body was too advanced to be that of Tina Andrews. And of course, Richard McIntosh was a good witness for himself. A clean-cut Macomb police officer with a military background, even if it was only the National Guard and not active duty. He was a good boy who lived at home and took care of his widowed mother. He did admit to owning a .38 caliber weapon and to knowing Billie Jo Lambert, though he insisted it was from seeing her around the streets once he became a policeman. His former girlfriend was also an excellent witness. Pretty and respectable, she had a remarkable memory for dates and times, in stark contrast to Billie Jo's testimony. She claimed she even remembered her work schedule for the week that Tina went missing. Because of her detailed testimony about her work hours, D.A. Piggott was able to poke a small hole in the alibi she gave McIntosh. She said she worked the night shift on August 13th, and she would not have been with her boyfriend in the hours that Tina was murdered. But in comparison to the complete character assassination of both the victim and his star witness, Piggott did not fare as well in his cross-examination of McIntosh and other defense witnesses. It looked like a slam dunk for McIntosh, but the trial actually ended in a hung jury. Though there are no official records, many rumors of how the jury split were in the newspaper. 50 years later, a black juror said that there were only two holdouts. Two white men voted for acquittal and would not change their minds. The second trial for Richard McIntosh evidently was mostly a repeat of the first trial. This is from newspaper accounts and the memory of witnesses some 50 years later, though, as no transcript was ever created for the second trial. The biggest difference was that D.A. Joe Piggott retired before the second trial. He went into private practice. His son later explained that he had four children to put through college and he needed the money. But the new D.A., Jim Kitchens, was just as determined as Piggott had been. They believed Billie Jo, and they had reason to believe her for more than just her word. Put that in your back pocket for a moment. The defense did put on some new witnesses. One highway patrol investigator, who suggested a different man was involved, but had no real proof. Another man, whose father had made inflammatory statements, suggesting he had been at the oil field that night, also testified. Neither witness was particularly strong, but perhaps enough for reasonable doubt. Richard McIntosh was acquitted at the second trial after the jury deliberated for 2.5 hours. And without a guilty verdict for the man that Billie Jo did see hit Tina, it seemed pointless to try Ted Fleming, a man she could only put in the passenger seat that night. The fact that after Jo Piggott left the DA's office and Kitchens was still willing to retry McIntosh speaks to both of their confidence that they had the right men. Both men later insisted they were sure. But to play devil's advocate, this was more than just a circumstantial case. This was a case based solely on the eyewitness testimony of one person, and she was a terrified young girl. I've already recently covered a case about the problems with eyewitness testimony, so I would be remiss if I didn't point out that that is a huge problem in the Tina Andrews case. Billie Jo knew she recognized Richard McIntosh, but she couldn't be sure she remembered him as a police officer at first. What she was sure of is that Tina knew the other man was a cop. It's very possible that after seeing both men around town, she became convinced these were the men who had picked up her and Tina that night. She saw them in police uniforms, possibly validating her memory, along with that of what her friend had said that fateful night. So I understand both the mistrial and the acquittal. I'm surprised that a DA in 1969 would have gone with an eyewitness of Billie Jo's social standing, except that there were too many other little details that stand out. Why were county officers suddenly brought in just 2 months before the indictments of McIntosh and Fleming? Did the police captain known as Big John uncover some evidence? Evidence that pointed in the direction of active duty officers. So Macomb police knew they had to bring in outside investigators to remain impartial. We will never know because his notes were either truly lost or were kept hidden by the Macomb police and were never part of the public record. And while the murder of Tina Andrews did dominate headlines, would it have been investigated differently if she had come from a better family? Most detectives would have investigated Tina's habits, her friends, where she hung out. That doesn't seem to be the case here. Trent Brown came to the same conclusion in his book. I believe Joe Piggott was an honorable man who did want justice, but he had no control over the police investigation. He could only use the evidence presented to him, and it did not come from the Macomb police. It came from Billy Joe. He did, however, know something about Richard McIntosh. Remember that thing I said to put in your back pocket? 5 months before Tina was murdered, McIntosh was implicated with two other men in Baton Rouge for aggravated rape. He was actually named as an accessory after the fact, though evidence suggested he participated. At a bail hearing for the three men, the 15-year-old girl in that case was also publicly shamed. She was asked to describe the, quote, sex she had with all three men standing right before her in the courtroom. Not rape, sex. When it came time for trial, the victim had skipped town. It's hard to blame her after how she was treated. The judge ordered a postponement of the charges against McIntosh and the other two men. But too much time passed, and a new hearing was required, but it never happened. Piggott knew about the case in Baton Rouge. But since no formal charges had been brought, he couldn't explore it in open court. He did, however, ask McIntosh if he knew the two men. And McIntosh just replied that they were two young men from the Macomb area. There was no follow-up. But the implication was clear now in retrospect. He was trying to rattle McIntosh by letting him know he knew about his past. But it didn't work. And it didn't work for Kitchens either. I can see why they believed Billy Joe and thought Richard McIntosh probably was a rapist. But that evidence was inadmissible, so their hands were tied. So they were left with only the eyewitness testimony of Billy Joe Lambert, a 15-year-old unwed mother considered white trash by the good people of Macomb. Would a girl of higher social standing have been treated the same way as Billy Joe was in court? Maybe, but probably not. Should Tina's school records have had any relevancy to her murder? No. But rape victims to this day are seemingly put on trial for their own behavior. It is not uncommon for the defense to blame the victim. And even though it was not focused on in McIntosh's trial, it's clear to me that Tina was a victim of sexual assault. But rather than focus on the state of undress of her body and the fact that her shorts had been put back on backwards without her underwear and her other clothes were found elsewhere, the state decided that they only needed to prove that Richard McIntosh had a hand in harming Tina Andrews. They did not need to prove motive. Motive isn't required by prosecutors then or now, but they will have a damned better case with one. If McIntosh had been convicted in the prior rape accusation, they would have had motive. I still believe they could have brought up Tina's clothing and the Lover's Lane area with rape as a motive. But they did not have a live witness to what happened to Tina after she was struck in the face. In fact, Billy Joe specifically said she did not hear a gunshot as she ran. And Tina's pitifully decomposed body bore no witness to what she endured that August night in the oil field. And I do believe that if Tina Andrews had come from a more respectable Macomb family, the investigation and trials would have been completely different. First of all, a white family in a higher social class would not have been scared to call the police right away. And while DNA evidence was not yet invented, they would have been able to establish signs of sexual assault had she been found sooner. I've also questioned the actual investigation, as did Trent Brown in his book, Murder in Macomb. The police were willing to look at shady men in the community, but they didn't put boots to pavement when it came to looking into Tina's life. If they questioned her school friends, they may have found another witness to place her at the Tiger's Den that night. They might have gotten Billy Joe to open up sooner. They might have found the third girl. The third girl might have been able to identify the men in the car. None of this happened. It was a shitty investigation and possibly a corrupt one. And lastly, would two men trolling for underage girls have picked up two girls from good, respectable families? I don't think they would have tried that. They certainly weren't in a nicer neighborhood that night. Tina and Billy Joe were vulnerable due to their marginalization as white trash in Macomb. One anonymous Macomb resident who who was old enough to remember Tina's case, told Trent Brown, quote, "Tina was white trash. That's why no one worked too hard to find out who killed her." 50 years later, people seem to understand that factor. Maybe they did at the time. But also at the time, Tina was a murdered white girl, so her face was in the newspaper. If this had been a black girl, would there have been any investigation at all? I spoke in the opening about a modern caste system. It's not a phrase we use much. We associate that phrase with India or ancient and medieval times. But think about it. We have our 1% at the very top. We have what some people are calling a dying middle class, meaning the haves and the have-nots, with the in-between growing smaller every day. We have people of color still fighting against systemic racism on every front. And women are still fighting for equal pay and seats at the table. We have the LGBTQ community still facing violence and inequality all over this country. And we still call each other names. If that's not a caste system, then what is it? Southern Fried True Crime is written and produced by me, Erica Kelly. The original graphic art is by Coley Horner, and Southern Fried's original music is by Rob Harrison of Gamma Radio. Special thanks to author Trent Brown. He reached out to me about Tina's case and graciously offered to share his hard work with me to bring more awareness to not only Tina's case, but to the issue of classism in the South. I discuss racism all the time, and I often talk about how money buys better justice. But your social class can also affect the justice you receive. I can't recommend enough Trent Brown's book, Murder in Macomb, The Tina Andrews Case. It has so much more detail and nuance that I couldn't possibly cover in one podcast episode. If you enjoyed today's show, don't forget to subscribe and please tell a friend or rate and review on iTunes. I'm also on most large platforms like Stitcher and Spotify. I've recently joined Stitcher Premium, and for 1 month, you can try it out for free by using my promo code SouthernFried. After that, for about $5 a month, you can listen to Southern Fried and many other shows ad-free. Go to StitcherPremium.com and use promo code SouthernFried to sign up for 1 free month. If you're interested in supporting the show, please visit my website, SouthernFriedTrueCrime.com. There you can sign up to be a patron of the show, make a one-time donation, or purchase show merchandise. That's SouthernFriedTrueCrime.com. If you have any case suggestions, please email SouthernFriedTrueCrime@gmail.com. I'm sorry, but I no longer answer private messages on social media. I manage 3 platforms and it's just too overwhelming. But please feel free to reach out by email. Not only do I get my most interesting and little-known cases from listener suggestions, I love hearing from you guys. Until next time, thanks so much for listening. Y'all take care.